Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we talk to our guest, we can't talk to you anyhow because we don't know where he is. I have an announcement that I need to make, and it is this. As a listener, nobody knows more about our programs and core values than you. We ask you to take a few minutes today to share your thoughts. By going to, and I know that many of you will do just that, visit WPR.org and click on the program survey link at the top of the homepage. And once we receive 600 responses, we will stop the survey. But your opinions matter to us, and it's always interesting to hear what you think. And you let us know what you think anyhow, which is a good thing about public radio. We also have a Facebook page if you want to comment on programs. That was a good discussion last hour. Very different perspectives on the issues, but entirely civil. And we just could have gone on with that all day long. It's one of those hours you just don't want to have end. So let us know what you think about what's going on here. We hope to soon find our guest. And this is the place where we want to be. This is a poem by Wendell Berry, which is at the beginning of the nature principle. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things. I rest in the grace of the world and I am free. Wendell Berry wrote that about the importance of nature, and we're going to go to that place that he described as soon as we find our guest. Richard Louv should be joining us, we hope, soon, author of The Nature Principle, Human Restoration, and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. His book has been translated into 10 languages and published in 15 countries. He's the founding chair of the Children and Nature Network and then was awarded the Audubon Medal presented by the National Audubon Society. The book is really interesting, and I do hope we can find him. I read a good chunk of it yesterday, so I can carry on with the discussion, but we really want him to be with us. The book looks at this. The natural world's benefits to our cognition and health will be irrelevant if we continue to destroy the nature around us. However, that destruction is assured without a human reconnection to nature. This is why the nature principle is about conservation, but also about restoring nature while we restore ourselves, about creating new natural habitats where they once were or never were, in our homes, workplaces, schools, neighborhoods, cities, suburbs, and farms. It's about the power of living in nature, not with it, but in it. The 21st century will be the century of human restoration in the natural world. And he's traveled all over the world, and he looks at some programs that are extremely interesting that help lower the body mass of children by having greener neighborhoods and doing more walking, looking at how mental health can be heightened by dealing with animals. You've heard about swimming with dolphins. How many minutes a day do we spend outside? And how important it is to spend more time, how we may have in our children undeveloped frontal lobes because they're spending so much time in front of screens, learning a whole new set of skills, which isn't awful. Our guest's children, Richard's children, do play video games, but they need to be able to develop their full minds and their bodies as a result of going outside, too, and being in the natural world. We found him. Thank goodness, or I would have not been able to stay in that space that Wendell Berry described. I would have been a little bit anxious. Richard is our guest. The book is The Nature Principle, Human Restoration, and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr. Think about this question as we enter this hour. How many minutes a day do you spend outside? And where do you spend that time outside? And you're going to be, I'm sure, inspired to change your life as a result of this conversation. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Well, first, my apologies. I was told by the publisher that it was a different time, and I wish I could say I was outside. That's why I didn't get the phone. But
that's what I was thinking. I just said not on the air. Maybe he's just out next to that tree watching the ant climb over his knee.
No, I was staring at the coffee pot.
Oh, well, I hope you get to the tree later on. Why don't you start? Because I really love the description of the backyard that you had when you were a kid and how that backyard changed. But start with the glory of the natural world that you found every day, and many will be able to relate to that.
Well, as a kid, I grew up outside of Raytown, Missouri, outside of Kansas City, and right on the edge of the suburbs. And I could go through my backyard and through the hedge and into a cornfield where my underground fort was, and then from there on into the woods and the fields that seemed to go on forever. And I owned those woods. I spent much of my boyhood with my collie in those woods, and I built tree houses and explored them. And I owned those woods to the extent that I think I pulled out hundreds of survey stakes that I knew had something to do with the bulldozers that were taking out other woods. I was told years later by a developer I would have been a lot more successful if I'd simply moved the stakes around.
And then it changed.
It took a while to change. The woods didn't change. They changed after we moved. Of course, the developers did come. But it changed in the sense that my family always had the best of times in nature. That was my memory of the best of my family. And we had a big garden in the backyard. My father spent many, many hours out there. I spent many, many hours out there with him. He loved to fish. My parents fished a lot, so I did a lot of that as a kid. We'd go down to the Ozarks, to the various lakes in southern Missouri. And over time, though, that changed. He became ill over time, and withdrew from nature, and his dream had always been to retire in the Ozarks and fish. And when time came for retirement, they built a house down on Table Rock Lake in Missouri, and he basically seldom left the kitchen table. He was had a mental illness, and there were substance issues, et cetera. So when I grew up, I really associated nature with health, with good times, and with being healthy, mentally healthy and physically healthy. And because I saw the withdrawal from nature. Now, as a kid, you make that kind of limited association in the terms that I don't think the withdrawal from nature caused his illness, which eventually led to his taking his own life.
Oh, how sad. I'm sorry.
But I did see that association. And so I actually tell that story in the book as a kind of, to be fair about my own bias, is to simply say that the nature principle is about many things, but one of the primary things is about the relationship between the time we spend outside in nature and our health. And the research behind that, all of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm basically saying I have a bias. I go into this issue with a bias.
It goes way back to when you're a boy, and as you write, you sensed nature's power to heal. Do you torture yourself with the question, or did you at any point, what if your father had quit his job as an engineer and become a forest ranger?
As a kid, I actually wished for that. I literally wished for that, and of course that didn't happen. But in the nature principle, I talk about, and probably making too much of this story because it's just a small story in a large book. But I did a chapter on eco-psychology and the emergence of eco-psychology, the emergence of nature therapy for mental illness and for depression and et cetera. I asked her about that, and basically what she said was, you know, what I asked was about nature therapy, and you know, maybe instead of just reliance on Quaaludes and Thorazine, you know, what if nature therapy had been around there then for mental health as it is today, more and more? And she said, well, it's hard to tell, you know, it could have helped him, or it may not have helped him, but it surely would have helped the whole family. Mm-hmm. Would have helped you cope with him, and you might have had him with you a little longer.
Hmm.
And I thought it was a fair answer.
Right. I don't think it's a small part of the book because it informs so much who you are and the fact that you've given us these books. So it's it forms you.
Thank you.
Your life. And I'm glad you did them. Early on in the introduction, you write about the movie, which I saw and really liked very much, 2010, Avatar, the most watched film in history. And it has to do, you think, more with our knowledge that endangered human species is paying an awful price as it loses touch with nature.
Well, I think there's no accident that this is the most, as of now, I think the most popular film in history. It very much touched a nerve. Now, people, you know, had various bones to pick with it that were mainly political. But in terms of its depiction of of a human or not so human relationship with nature, it captured, for instance, in its extremes. It captured what I felt like when I was a boy in those woods. You know, that animation, people criticize it, it's outlandish. Well, of course, it's otherworldly. But to me, as a kid in the woods, that was not an exaggeration. And I think for many kids, that sense of wonder and awe and the magical quality of it, I think that touched people. And it touched people. You know, there were stories after that movie came out that people left the movie and got depressed. And the reason was they were going back to a life that was so devoid of nature. And James Cameron, who made the movie, when it first came out, he was interviewed in several interviews about what the movie was about. And he said the same thing that he later said to a group of environmentalists in L.A., which is, the book is about nature deficit disorder, and he literally said that, and that's the phrase that was coined in Last Child in the Woods. And at one point he said, yeah, let's call it nature deficit disorder. And I thought, yeah, Jim, let's. but I was great. I mean, I thought that was great. The idea is for that phrase, as corny as it is, to enter the language because people know exactly what it is. And that's certainly what I experienced with Last Child in the Woods and with the new book, The Nature Principle, which applies more to adults. I think people recognize that in themselves.
That movie is also remarkably high-tech, and one of the things that you suggest to reshape our lives and in the future is that the more high-tech our lives become, and they're only going to become more so, the more nature we need to achieve natural balance. Can you amplify that?
Well, I'm not anti-tech. I'm not a Luddite. Technology is with us and will be with us, and increasingly so, in wonderful ways and in some disturbing ways. The impact of technology on our lives, we really don't fully understand yet. And when I say technology, I mean computers and electronic technology primarily. There are studies, though, that are indicating that the more time we spend on our electronics, you know, looking at our screens and with our electronic gadgets, the more depressed we become. I think anybody who sits late at night and flips through the television channels and can't seem to escape that pattern, you know, they just keep flipping and flipping. If they monitor how they feel when they're done, they don't feel enlightened particularly. They don't feel good. They usually feel depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's kind of a metaphor for what too much technology in our lives does to us. And too few hours outdoors and too many hours working, too many hours in intense concentration on a screen that has a downside. So for that downside, we need an antidote. And I make the case in the nature principle that nature, the natural world, whether it's in our backyard or our neighborhood park or in the wilderness, is our most cost-effective antidote to the downside of technology. It's one of our most cost-effective treatments, more and more people believe, for depression, for mental illness, for attention deficit disorder. There's a story in this morning's New York Times about the rise of myopia, the huge increase in just a few years of how many people have are nearsighted.
I saw that you write about that. I found that fascinating.
I wrote about it in the book, and now there's a good piece in the New York Times just this morning. And again, linking that to the lack of sunshine in people's lives.
Hmm.
I believe that's an Australian study. I think that the natural world has been undervalued in terms of its effect on us as a species and on our mental health and our physical health, and also on our ability to learn. One of the reasons I'm not anti-tech is because, obviously, computers, the Internet is good. I actually happen to be talking on a telephone. But in the book, I make the case for what I call the hybrid mind. In the Nature Principle, there's a chapter called Nature Neurons. It looks at the research and the common wisdom, really, on how getting outside really helps us learn. It excites all of our senses at the same time, optimum state of learning. Many studies, for instance, show that backpackers, when they get back from a backpacking trip, can actually do better on proofreading than people who go on an urban vacation or go on no vacation at all. Study after study show that this stimulates our minds, stimulates our brains in ways that we don't fully understand. So the idea of the hybrid mind, the best description of that was given to me inadvertently by a cruise ship, a fellow who trains people to become pilots of cruise ships. He said he gets two kinds of students. One kind of student grew up mainly inside, in front of computers and video games, et cetera. He said, that kind of student has a great talent. I need that kind of student. That kind of student is terrific at the electronics in the ship. And then he gets in a second kind of student. That kind of student grew up outside, hiking and fishing and hunting and whatever. They were outside. And that kind of student, he said, also has a great talent. And I need that talent. That kind of student actually knows where the ship is. And he wasn't I laughed too, but he wasn't being cute about it. He was
right.
Being literal.
Exactly.
And in fact, there's a chapter at the beginning of the Nature Principle called Singing for Bears, which is about the senses. And the scientists who study the senses no longer talk about just five senses. They talk about as many as 30 human senses. And there's a cluster of senses that have to do with your sense of where you are in space, where you are in a room, where you are outside. And so he was being fairly literal about that, about knowing where the ship is. He said the best kind of student for him, the optimum student, would be a student who had both sets of talents,
mm-hmm.
who had enough experience with electronics. They were good electronics, but had been outside enough that they had these other senses that had been stimulated. That, to me, is the hybrid mind. And I think that the idea of going forward in education, we ought to keep that in mind, rather than being stuck in this false dichotomy of technology versus nature.
Let's go back to that Singing for Bears chapter, because it's quite a story. You and your younger son, Matthew, hiking upstream on Alaska's Kodiak Island, which has the largest population of brown bears, I believe, in the world. And so you also have to learn about bears. And it's a very exciting chapter because it is awakening literally the hair on the back of your neck and all of your powers of sight and smell and everything so that you won't get hurt.
Yeah, it comes in handy.
Yeah,
these senses.
Right.
The story actually begins the book. my younger son and I we were in Kodiak, Alaska, and we were going up a stream. And this is a small stream, which is more dangerous because you don't have as much room to see the bears, and the bushes and the trees are right up against the stream. And up that stream is Bear Kitchen. That's where the salmon go to die, and so that's where the bears go. And these are huge bears, many of them. These are Alaskan brown bears, are grizzly bears, but there are many, many of them on Kodiak. And so going up the stream, what you do is you do everything you're not supposed to do when you fish. You make noise. You talk. You sing. You sing for bears.
you wear bells or something, don't you?
Yeah, you wear a bear bell. They're bear bells up there. They know they don't work particularly well, and they call them bear tums. But going up there, the guide taught us how to smell for bears. And once you've smelled that particular smell, you never forget it. Hmm. It's a combination of bear musk and rotten salmon, because the bears like to roll in the salmon. And he said, if you smell that smell, that means one of two things. Either the bear is right there in the bushes and you can't see it, or the bear's just left. And so it's useful to know that smell, because when you smell that smell, you start singing for bears.
Right.
You make a lot of noise. You don't want to surprise them.
Right.
So later I realized that a study had been done around that same time using college students, and they found that the study found that human beings have some bloodhound in them. We have that capacity to track only with our noses, with blindfolds and ears plugged. We can track through the woods with our noses. We've forgotten that physiological ability, but it's there. It's there with a lot of other senses, like echolocation that bats use. Human beings have some of that ability, and in fact, people who have lost their sight, some of them are learning how to use echolocation to make their way through the house. So, you know, the argument I make in the outset of the Nature Principle is that, yes, this book is about health, about the enormous influence, positive influence, that nature can be on our health, physical health, mental health. And yes, it's about our ability to learn. But fundamentally what this is about is our ability to feel and be more alive.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of us, not all of us, really want that. We want to feel and to be more alive, and that's what this book is about.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Richard. Richard Louve is our guest. His latest book is The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. His previous work, I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. 800-486-8655 is our number. A couple lines are open right now. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls for Richard with Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. This call should really be from my wife, who's read your book, Nature Deficit Disorder, and absolutely loved it and lives by it, really.
Oh.
And she is, I know Veronica Rickert interviewed some people on this last year, but I just wanted to mention the environmental education that goes on at the Madison School District School Forests. And your guest probably knows that Wisconsin has had school forests, an idea borrowed from actually Australia, since 1925. And what this is, the Madison School District has 400 acres outside of Madison, very pristine woods with, I think there's probably 40 or 50 nesting birds there, including a heron rookery. And what the school district does is pays to have teachers with their classroom go out. My wife does the environmental education when they come out there and gets the kids traipsing through these woods, and you know, everything from doing stream dipping with the kindergartners up to she's actually done projects with GPS tracking of heron nests and sinkholes and other things in the woods. The data being then transferred to the Department of Natural Resources. So really getting different levels of projects for Madison school kids, students out there. And I just want to say it's a great program. And surprisingly, there are very few teachers, I won't say few, but a small number of teachers take advantage of it. I think she said, told me once, and I may be wrong on this, like 10% or 10 or 20% only take advantage of this, at least it's currently in the school funding, who knows in the future, but they have had the access to a school bus driver and ride out there for the day or the half day or whatever, and there's just an incredible number of interesting things they do out there. And she has seen kids from some really, let's say, poorer parts of Madison who hardly ever, you know, get their feet on grass, get out there and just go home grinning. They just absolutely love it. I just wanted to throw that out as something that is being done to deal with the disorder, and I will listen off the air.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Jeff, I do know about that program, and I know that Wisconsin has this very interesting history of decades ago setting aside forest for schools. And these, I believe, exist across Wisconsin. And some of them are used now, finally, and some of them are not. And it was kind of a forgotten thing that these schools had access to these forests. And I think that the kind of program you're describing is wonderful. Unfortunately, many schools are not providing the school buses, and many schools across the United States are even canceling or cutting recess, and field trips are a thing of the past. This is tough on teachers as well as it is on kids. In the Nature Principle, I talk about a study that was done in Canada of teachers and found that the teachers who were able to get their students outside of the classroom and into nature on a regular basis are far less likely to burn out early than other teachers. So this is an example of how we have to think about ourselves as well as kids. One of the reasons I wrote The Nature Principle is that after the book came out and I went all over the country, I'm still going all over the country and outside the country giving sermonettes on this, including in Wisconsin, and almost always an adult will come up and say, as a woman did in Seattle, and grab my lapels and say, listen, Rich, nature deficit disorder is about adults have nature deficit disorder too. And I said, let me go. But I thought it was an interesting idea. I wrote it down. I heard that more and more and more. And the teachers in particular, I think, are in need of this as much as their students are. And finally, what the caller said about the transformation of these kids who have not been in the natural world very much is absolutely true. What I hear again and again are that kids from urban neighborhoods, they get off that field trip school bus if they're lucky enough to have one. They stand there in the park and they ask the first question they ask, where are the lions and the tigers? That they're terrified. But that terror goes away very quickly. And I can't tell you how many teachers have told me that the troublemakers in class become the leaders in nature when they take the class out there. And they're not just talking about they become better behaved. They say these troublemakers become leaders in the most positive sense.
Well, and you, in the book, highlight so many programs that are taking place all over the world, programs in the United States, even close to schools, that help provide antidotes to obesity. The Upward Bound program has been wonderful for taking kids out of cities to teach them those kinds of leadership skills that you learn by being in the wilderness. The amount of evidence that shows that it has a whole host of benefits is pretty substantial.
And again, for children, but also for adults. In fact, there's been more research on adults along this line. And one of the reasons this is so important is that as of 2008, more people in the world live in cities than in the countryside. The human race went over that hump only in 2008. Now, the U.S. went through that in the 1940s, but now the whole world, this is all of humanity now, more of humanity lives in cities. What that means in the future as that continues, and it probably will, is one of two things. Either the human species will lose its intimate day-to-day contact with nature, or it will mean the beginning of a new kind of city. And so much of the book thinks about what would it be like in our neighborhoods, our homes, our schools, our workplaces, to be as immersed in the natural world, in nature, even if we create that nature,
mm-hmm.
every day as we are in technology and electronics, what would that be like? And I think it would be a much better world.
Mm. Do you live in the city, Richard, or country?
I live in San Diego.
Oh, in San Diego.
Yeah.
That's a pretty long way from your childhood.
Long story, too.
So how many minutes a day do you get outside, sir?
Oh, now you're putting me on the spot. I have nature deficit disorder.
No.
My name is Rich. I have nature. It's true.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, I spend way too much time on airplanes these days. But no, I make myself go outside. I do. I used to fish more than I do now. What I do now more is take pictures. I take my digital camera and I go on hikes. And I force myself, because I know I feel this. I feel that I get a little strange when I go out, when I'm not outside very much. And I have to get out there. I know it has a direct impact on my mood and lifts depression. It makes me physically feel much better. And one of the aspects of this that's so interesting is that when it comes to physical and mental health, there really does seem to be a value added to exercising in nature as compared to nature.
Oh, that was an interesting part of the book. Yeah.
Yeah. One study looked at, for instance, there are several studies were like this, but they looked at people on a treadmill in a gym, in an indoors gym, for instance, compared them to people who were doing exercise in nature, green exercise, which can mean hiking or gardening, et cetera. In both of these groups, they were expending the same exact amount of energy. They were burning the same amount of calories. The people on the treadmills got healthier. The blood pressure went down. Mental acuity and depression went up, and depression lifted. That's good, you know, on the treadmill indoors in a gym. But the people expending the same amount of energy in green exercise in nature, they got even better. There was a margin of improvement there that the scientists did not understand. We don't understand how much we need nature.
Yeah. Well, you also, just something as simple as having a little garden in your backyard or a space down the road for a community garden, just all those muscles you use by tending to things, you know, bending over, and that's why people get sore from all those muscles they haven't used, but we're supposed to be using those muscles.
That's right. And I had trouble in the nature principle as I wrote it, you know, I was going to have a section on mental health, a section on physical health. It turns out, of course, that all of that is intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to the conclusion that, you know, we're familiar with the idea of the mind-body connection. I think that we're missing something there. I think we need to begin to talk about the mind-body-nature connection.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Carrie in Mercer. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, it's actually Terry.
Oh, hi, Terry.
And I had 2 points. One was, I'm an environmental educator. When I was in graduate school, I remember looking at a study that evaluated famous environmentalists like Leopold, Muir, I think Rachel Carson, a number of them, and found points of commonality in their childhood, things like long-term exposure to the outdoors, loss of a special place, kind of a pivotal aha moment experience like a backpacking trip. There were, I think, 6 of those factors. And I've thought about that a lot during my career working with people. And my second point was that right now I'm working on a project up here with the Long-Term Ecological Research Site, which is a National Science Foundation-funded UW research site. And one of the things that they're doing that I think relates to this is we've started taking on art-science collaborations to try and get people more interested in the science of work on these northern lakes and looking at it through an art lens of music or visual arts or writing. And there's actually quite a movement in the country looking at art-science collaborations as a way to get people outdoors and relating to science And right now we have a traveling exhibit that is at the Lac du Flambeau in Woodland India Arts Center that's going to be traveling around in the North Woods, and we're going to have wayside exhibits. So hopefully people are going to be out on the boat landings looking at a wayside exhibit sign that has the artwork, encouraging them to go to the art show, encouraging them to go to a website and put their phenology observations. There's bike trails that are connected to some of these. So we're kind of looking at a whole way of trying to get people outdoors on these lakes where they can then learn the science.
That sounds wonderful. Richard.
It does sound wonderful. And you're right. The studies, and more than one, show that the number one characteristic of people who describe themselves as conservationists or they are ecologically conscious, et cetera, is whether or not they had much experience in nature when they were kids. So you have to ask the question, what if that experience for kids, that hands-on experience in nature, begins to disappear even faster than it's been disappearing? What if it disappears virtually altogether? Where will future stewards of the Earth come from? I do think it can be turned around. Obviously, there's a Children in Nature movement that began a few years ago. The Children in Nature Network is a nonprofit that grew out of Last Child in the Woods. You can go to childrenandnature.org, and you can see programs like the one that the caller described emerging all over the country, in fact, around the world. The other thing that the caller touched on is relationship with art, and certainly I've heard from many artists around the country who see that connection with nature. And I hear from many teachers saying that students have a hard time visualizing anymore. So when it comes to visual arts, unless it's on a computer, it's tough. And often those images are compilations of other people's images rather than their own. So I think there's a real opportunity here for artists to get involved with connecting people, kids and adults, with nature.
Thanks very much, Terry, for your call. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Yes, I recall the time there was this guy talking about diet, and he said that humans were on the Earth for several million years, and most of the time was walking through the woods, collecting, gathering, and catching a little bit of meat, and sleeping during the night. I mean, we evolved to do all this stuff. Also, if we don't have this connection to nature, I mean, that's why I think people who have this connection, you talk about global warming, they get it. Versus these people who don't, you know, they get a lot of people don't believe in it because they really are disconnected.
Richard.
Well, let me say that there were two reasons I wrote the book. One was because of the adult connection to nature, which I think has been undervalued. And I don't think the Children in Nature movement is going to last unless adults, including adults without children of their own, see what's in it for them. And there's a lot in it for the rest of us. But the second reason that I wrote the book is, you know, as I've gone around the country and outside the country for these last few years, I often end these speeches by paraphrasing Martin Luther King, who said and demonstrated in many ways that any movement, any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want to go to. You know, his speech was not called I Have a Nightmare. So the nature principle within my very limited abilities is my attempt to paint a picture of a world I'd like to go to, and one that I can start creating right now, and the reader can start creating right now in their backyard, in their home, et cetera, in which nature comes back into our lives. One of the things that's very disturbing to me is, I could be wrong about this, I'm not basing this on any studies, because I don't think those studies have really been done, but I think that most Americans, when they conjure up instant images of the far future, I don't mean, you know, thinking, sitting down and thinking rationally about it. I think what images pop into their head of the far future, I think most Americans see images of Blade Runner and Mad Max. They see a post-apocalyptic world in which nature has been stripped from our lives and our humanity has been stripped from us as well. If that is the dominant image that pops up in Americans' minds of the future, if I'm right about that, and I could be wrong, But if I'm right, then we're in real trouble that transcends even climate change in a sense. Because, you know, the old saying about be careful what you wish for, you just might get it. It's almost as if we're drawn to that future like a moth is to a flame. There are a lot of reasons for that, I think, if I'm right. Obviously, pop culture describes that future. But I think environmentalism itself has painted such a grim picture of the future, a hopeless picture in many ways, that journalists like me also have played into this, that we've created that picture of the future. There's no real good alternative image. Now, yes, we can talk about a world in which, you know, robots are us and everything is nanotechnology and all. But, you know, that leaves out human beings. What about human beings and other species? What's the future going to be like for all of us? And so the nature principle is my attempt to paint that picture. And again, it's not something that's abstract. It's something that we can start doing today. One of the basic principles is that conservation is no longer enough. Now we need to begin to create nature. As ironic as that sounds, we can truly green our cities, not just in a sense of more solar panels, but we can create extraordinarily livable environments in our homes, in our neighborhoods, in our cities. We can do that through design. We can do that through individual decisions. And I think that to get there, what we actually need is what I call a new nature movement that goes beyond sustainability, beyond traditional environmentalism.
Richard Louv is our guest this hour, journalist, author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. That's his book prior to the one that is out right now, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. He is founding chair of Children and Nature Network, and that's, you can find that online, childrenandnature.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to an email that will bring us into new territory. It's from Vicky in Duluth, Minnesota. While I understand that it's unavoidable for humans to look at anything in terms of how those things might benefit us, I also think it's important to look at things without regard to our needs. When we look at nature this way, we seem inclined to say that nature is neither good nor bad, but nearly every conscious creature will die with some degree of degradation and suffering. To apply human values, which is, after all, the best we can do, we'd have to admit that nature is not good, but rather is cruel. This is the starting point for deeper understanding.
Well, nature is both good and cruel.
Mm-hmm.
I think more than, you know, another way to look at this is that nature is beautiful, and whether it is cruel or good, and I agree with the email writer that this is more complex than just, you know, nature is nice, cute bunnies. Obviously, you know, I began with a description of the Alaskan brown bears that you really don't want to be their lunch. So that very cruelty, in fact, in nature teaches us. In that particular chapter, for instance, it's a chapter about the senses. I list in that chapter with what I believe is the most important sense, which is the sense of humility. And we can't have that when we separate ourselves with nature. Our hubris will truly kill us if we are truly separated from nature.
You know, I find it's funny you mentioned a bunny. I find myself this past couple of weeks in this dilemma because I live smack dab in the middle of Milwaukee, you know, very city, sirens go, close to a hospital, you know, it's city living. But I have a little backyard where I have, you know, a little garden that I created, and I was reading your book out in the backyard last night until it started getting nasty out, and there's a bunny for the last 2 weeks has chosen to sit almost next to me, which is just amazing. You know, we kind of look at each other, and it's kind of fun to look at his eyes and twitch in his mouth. But I also have a dog who is my dear friend and usually sits right next to me. So now I'm facing this dilemma. I know the bunny is there, so I can't bring the dog out because the dog would be inclined to kill the bunny, right? But all of this is happening in my urban neighborhood, and it's creating this constant dilemma for me every day. Who am I going to sit and read with? The bunny, who will probably show up, or the dog?
That's a good story.
Well, who should I choose? What do I do? I don't know what to do about it.
Well, I don't know. Parcel out the time. Give them lottery tickets to get time with you.
There you go.
You know, and as you're talking about that, I'm looking at my backyard through my office window, and which is terribly overgrown. And it's not because I have such a higher consciousness. It's because I hate yard work. But it invites, by being overgrown, I hope with many native species, it invites all kinds of life into it. Mm. And I'll sit here sometimes, and I'll be looking at the computer and working too much, and I'll look out there, and I'll see rabbits going by, or late in the evening I'll maybe see a raccoon or two going by. And I know coyotes go by. I don't see them very much, but I know they go by. And every now and then, when the sun comes out, I look out there, and for some reason, the last couple of years, our backyard has been filled with lizards, fence lizards.
Oh.
And these lizards are incredible. You know, people think they're simple creatures. Well, they have some kind of complex thing going on out there. Those push-ups mean something. And there's more posturing out there than there is in the U.S. Congress. And here's the deal. Those lizards make me laugh.
Oh.
And that laughter improves my health, my mental health,
right.
My physical health. And I use that as an example of, in the nature principle, I talk about human nature social capital, that we're not the only species in town, including
right.
in our
we
city.
We sure aren't.
And the studies have shown that the parks with the highest biodiversity have the best impact on human depression, human psychology, et cetera, that the more wildlife we have in our cities, actually, the better it is for our mental health, and et cetera. You know, when we talk about social capital, Robert Putnam, et cetera, talks about that. That's our human networks. You know, how many people can you call if you get in real trouble? That's human social capital.
Yeah.
Why do we only talk about humans? Why don't we include other species in our social capital?
Right.
And some cities are beginning to do that. Portland is consciously bringing more wildlife into the cities, and with that comes a few problems that can be dealt with. But what you get more than anything is an improvement in mental health. You get an increase in people's just sense of being alive. There are more. The most productive peregrine falcon nest in Portland, Oregon now is on a bridge in the city of Portland.
Really?
The whole state, that's the most productive.
Oh, my.
So by making our cities more welcome and increasing the amount of wildlife in our cities,
mm-hmm.
we increase our social capital, our human nature social capital, and that makes us all better off.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a couple of final calls. The hour is zooming on by. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Richard. What a great show. I again realize how lucky I was growing up. I'm 75 years old now, live on the south side of Wisconsin Rapids, within a half mile of where I grew up in the 40s, and on 2 Mile Avenue, which was a dirt road, which didn't even have a street sign. You had to know where it was. And we swam and fished in the 2 Mile Creek and in the 4 Mile Creek and in the lakes around here and camped. Our campsite on the 4 Mile Creek is now the location of the left dog leg and the number 10 fairway of the Ridges golf course. But I at the time growing up, we did all these things and took it for granted. And kind of ironically, we envied some movie characters who we would see now and then at the double feature on Saturday afternoon called the Bowery Boys. And they lived in New York City, and they led such an exciting life, and I kind of envied them. Only later did I realize how little I had to envy. But I recently obtained an aerial photograph of Wisconsin Rapids from 1938, and it's difficult to locate some of the places that are there now, but I can find 2 Mile Avenue and in the major streets around here and the old creeks. And it's amazing how much more wooded it is. It was farmland then, and there were pheasants and there were quail and the hedgerows, and you very seldom would see a deer. You'd see a fox now and then. And now it's all grown up, and some of the some of the trees that were planted in the school forest, my older sister planted some of them when she was in high school, are now white pines that are, you can't even wrap your arms around them. They're so big.
Isn't it interesting, Richard, that when people talk about these experiences, poetry comes from them? I mean, he was speaking poetically.
It does.
Yeah.
It is interesting.
Well, we are out of time, so outside we go. Richard, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. It's really, it's important. It's a good book. It's well written, too.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Richard Louv, our guest, and the book is new from him, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Richard also is the author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your calls and emails. There were so many of them, and well, it's just a shame, but that'll happen. So we'll put some of these on Facebook because there's some wonderful memories that people have mailed into us. Just go to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Until tomorrow.